This is Phil Pritchett. Welcome to the P2 Podcast.
There's never been a better time than right now to be a musician.
Giddy hit Austin!
My name's Phil, and I just want to play rock and roll, man.
Tougher than the rest.
Romans, countrymen, lend me your ears. It's Phil Pritchett here on the P2 Podcast, your one and only source for great life and music enlightenment, coming to you every week. Thanks for tuning in, everybody. Oh, man, jamming some Blueprint Garage Volume 3 there. Freaking you out there a little bit.
I didn't even know there was a Volume 3.
Yes, with the last few weeks, I've been playing the Blueprint Garage Volume 3 jams that are coming out of the... At the top of the show,
God, you make just wetting
people's.
A year.
That's right, wetting people's appetite for just some vibey Pritchett stuff that's never really released. Well, folks, let me just say so. We delve into current events sometimes on this show, but it gets a little cloudy. The lines get blurred a bit because on this show, when we talk about a oil leak catastrophe, when we talk about problems with Greece or problems with massive debt. Or if we talk about a suspicious vehicle being parked full of explosives, that only means that Kurt South has parked his car here in the parking lot of Trinidad World Recording Studios. How's it going, South?
I'm good.
How's that for a current events intro there?
Awesome intro.
You know, it
can connect the dots.
Connect the dots with all this going on here and how it can apply to us here. Crazy times out there, aren't they?
Well, they don't have to be crazy, but don't get me started on that.
Mm. We got some good feedback from our last the Publishing 101 and the 360 deal got a lot of response out
there.
From all the younger guys, the would-be musicians out there trying to get things rolling.
Wondering how it works,
you know. It's hard to read those thick old books. What's the one everybody reads? The Donald Passman.
I saw that in Half Price Books yesterday, actually.
That's sort of an industry standard. Yeah. Passman's a music industry attorney from the University. I think he went to the University of Texas, and he wrote the book. What's it called? Everything you need to know about the music.
Yeah, everything you need to know about the music industry.
He's got several editions of it, updated. A good read, Donald Passman. Anybody in the music business will tell you. Will point you in that direction. A good book to read. Asked about. I got a from. You know Chad Lancaster?
Yeah.
Chad. He emailed. So he knew you and some other friend. What, you got a cat out here? What's going on?
Yeah, well, actually, I stepped over like three cats.
Yeah, the neighbors are just like breeding cats next door.
I've got a pistol.
Yeah? You can step out there with
that. Get rid of a few. Have a cat for dinner.
But we had an email. He's following up because we kind of got cut off there at the end of the 360 deal, Publishing 101 thing. Chad was asking about the recording, the actual sound recordings that a lot of times a band will... you know, they'll do a record for Warner Brothers or something, and then later, and then it'll be out of print forever. You know, and do they not own it or whatever? You know, and of course, the short answer is yes, they don't own it. There's a lot of levels of rights. It's hard to get your head around it. You know, there's the songwriter, the publisher, and then there's also the sound recording. Meaning, if the label is giving you Kurt South $250,000 to go to Abbey Road Studios for a week. Record your record, you turn it in, it sounds great, it's on the radio, They own those masters. That's the term, the master
recordings.
The
physical master tape is theirs.
So if they record a Kurt South record over there and they say, man, this is just a bunch of crap. We're not even releasing this. And you're hey, wait a minute, I want to put this record out. They're like, well, you can't. We own the masters. We paid to make it, and it's not in our business interest to release it. We're not throwing any more good money after bad. You're finished, South. That's all. Then you're in a position to where that so many guys get in a position where they try to get a hold of, or the label goes broke or folds up. You're in a position, as so many artists are who have major record deals, of trying to get their old albums, because they want to, you know, put them
control
on iTunes.
Distribution.
Control distribution.
There's still a lot of albums that I'll search for every now and then, you know, and it's some guy who used to be on a major label isn't anymore.
You can't find it anywhere. That's right.
It's kind of like a lot of people may have heard about Wilco back in, I think it was 2003. They made Yankee Hotel Foxtrot.
Yeah, sure.
Which that album took them from being a big underground band to really big national exposure, and it was their biggest selling album to date. Went gold, as a matter of fact.
Absolutely, yeah.
They made that album.
They made the movie about it.
Yeah, I'm trying to break your heart.
Yeah.
They were on Warner Brothers. And they turned that album into Warner Brothers, and Warner Brothers said it's a bunch of unlistenable crap.
Right.
We're not going to put it out.
Is this after Summer Teeth? Was that the one before that, the Warner Brothers?
Oh, there was a couple. Yeah.
Maybe
Teeth was their second one, so this was like their fourth or fifth.
Right. But they turned it in Yankee Hotel Foxtrot.
Yes.
And said, hey, here's our new record.
They said it's
unlistenable. We don't want to put it out, right.
So they were able to negotiate to get out of their record contract.
Mm-hmm.
Then they took that album and they shopped it around to other labels.
Hey, here it is. It's ready to go.
Ready to put out.
They own the sound recording.
They bought the masters, right. Basically. Well, the irony of that is Reprise Records decided to release Yankee Hotel Foxtrot. They were owned by Warner Brothers, who originally turned them down.
Right.
So
they basically got paid twice to release the same album.
They got paid two times to release the same album, and of course it spurned them on to a whole new level of stardom.
That's right. That's right. There's so many wild stories like that, guys with their masters that never get released. A very common story is, it happens a lot in the singer-songwriter, adult alternative world, where you're not talking about millions of records. You're talking about maybe a smaller label. Those tend to go out of business or get bought up by some other huge entity or something like that. So there's all you read stories about people like, oh gosh, you know, Amy Mann or you know, Kelly Willis or someone trying to buy their last record from their label, and you're always like, well, what does that mean? And that's what happened. They've already recorded it. It's in the can. Oh man, we're putting it out in January. Don't worry, January rolls around, and they just got bought by. You know,
Universal,
and they've dissolved everything. Now they're trying to just, look, how much could I pay you just to get my album back, and then I can release it and do whatever I want with it. That happened to my good friend Wes Cunningham. He did the podcast here, and they released his first Warner Brothers record. And then he had already made a second one that was ready to go, but they said, well, we're not going to release it. So it's just shelved, you know. Because it takes a lot of money for a label to release something. I mean, to get it in the stores, you're talking about another, you know, influx of cash just to get it out there.
Right.
So it's understandable that labels sometimes might say, well, look, we've spent, you know, whatever it is, $150,000 recording this.
$1 million.
Yeah, well, you know, whatever it is. We've spent $200,000 in Abbey Road and on catering and hiring the orchestra. And yes, it sounds great, but man, we're looking down the barrel of another big chunks of $100,000 just to get it distributed and shipped and on the radio and all that. And, man, you know, we're not going to do it. So there's a lot of, God, there's just tons of stuff out there that never, it's hard to find now.
What a murky mess.
Indeed it is. But that's where you hear about, I think Chad specifically mentioned Mike McClure was releasing some of his older, I don't know why.
Maybe stuff that when he was on
Great Divide
or something.
Maybe that. They gave back to him, or he bought, or something.
Yeah.
Finally worked out a deal. Yeah, man, having those rights. There's the rights to the songs themselves and how those are used. You're the songwriter of it, so you get a piece of it. But that's just the, you know, whether that song is recorded in any form, but that those master tapes, you know, if the label's paying for that studio time and the tape and the producer and the engineer and
the
all
guy
the,
who brings the coffee,
all the all the musicians, stuff. Man, they're buying those masters, man, the sound recording, those tapes and the right to distribute them and duplicate them as they see fit.
Well, now labels are the major label system as we've known it is breaking down at a rapid pace, mm-hmm. and I know labels now on some level are offering guys deals where, hey, we're just going to license your album.
Really?
Yeah. And yeah. We're not going to own the masters. We're just going to license it for
have the right to distribute it.
Distribute it, promote it, market it.
And that keeps them from having to come up with the upfront money.
Rob Baird, that's how his record deal was structured. Yeah, yeah. His record label just said, hey, you own the masters. And Rob paid for the album to be recorded on his own dime, took him the completed product, and the label, in turn, they're going to distribute it and market it and get it on radio and all that stuff. So that's a little more viable of a business model, especially now that artists can afford to make their own record without having a label advance them $250,000 or something silly like that.
That's right. I also wanted to touch more. We kind of ran out of time, but the real benefit in publishing, we talked about the 50% pie last time, that every dollar coming down the pike because who was it? Keith Urban, recorded one of my songs. 50 cents goes to Phil, and 50 cents went to Frank Liddell, my publisher, or whoever in our fictitious world. But just how the real payoff is for those publishers is they can sell the publishing rights,
right?
Perhaps to their entire catalog, and how lucrative that can be. And there's a lot of stories in Nashville. A lot of dudes on the hill out there, and you're like, well, who's that guy? Well, he had a publishing company a while back. Well, what that guy does is he accrues the rights to songs. He's getting those, a check coming down the pike for $400,000. He's putting his $200,000 in here for himself. He's signing writers, and he can look at his publishing catalog and say, hey, it makes me $2 million a year gross just from radio play. I own all these hits and stuff that are still getting played, or whatever it is. He can show income of X, for a year. And then he might go to a big, EMI or a Sony or something like that and say, hey, I'm looking to sell my catalog. Would you want my catalog? And they'd say, well, yeah, we'll give you 5 times earnings per year. We'll give you $10 million. He goes, man, I want this and that, or I want a little more than that. So you negotiate, but the bottom line is, EMI might write some guy who just owns the publishing rights. They might say, okay, here's your $11 million, and that guy says, all right, you now own the rights to my 15,000 song catalog, maybe only a handful of which really make a lot of money, but that's enough,
right? That's for all you need.
And then he just goes off into the distance, and the songwriters for those songs don't get paid for that. That's my understanding. Now, I don't know if some guys might pay. There might be some residual from that. Like, hey, if your catalog or song is purchased by another entity, maybe you're entitled to some sort of payment. But I don't think so.
I don't think so.
You know what I mean? I think as a songwriter, you find out that, man, Liddell just sold his whole catalog to EMI, and I called his office. He just goes, oh, Phil, I sold the catalog. Call them if you have any questions.
But that writer would still get some residual royalties as those songs
as
being
it earns,
played.
Correct. But you never get the big hunk.
Yeah, don't get a piece of the
sale.
You know
what I'm saying? No, you don't. I mean, for the publisher, the guy getting songs cut and owning those copyrights in Nashville, there is potentially a big payoff if you have some big hits in your arsenal to sell it.
Well, a couple years ago, Courtney Love sold like half of their Nirvana catalog.
Oh, is that right?
For I think $50 million or something stupid like that to Sony or EMI or somebody.
Yeah.
So I mean, there's huge money, especially in a catalog like Nirvana's.
Oh yeah.
I mean, my catalog currently is for sale.
What, for $38? How much is
currently
it? Because I've got
sale.
My checkbook out over here, and I'm gonna make you a deal on some of it. What do you ask? What are you looking
$7
for?
$7 million.
$7 million.
And it's
just
yours.
Cash up front.
Yes.
So if I gave you $6 million in cash today, you wouldn't take it. You'd just say no way.
Yes.
You would take it?
I'd put it on sale. All for right. you. If you're asking somebody else, $7 million, you can have it all.
Well, the songwriter is the songwriter, and the publisher can switch hands. And the way that switches hands is through money, baby. That's how the Beatles, when they saw signed their record deal, they just signed this extra piece of paper that said they don't own their publishing anymore. And they, of course, just toured the world and, you know, partied and smoked weed and talked in British accents or whatever they did and enjoyed themselves. But it wasn't until years later that the old record label, whoever actually owned the rights to those Lennon McCartney songs, sold them. I think it was in the 80s, and Michael Jackson, but they were just on an auction block, like a painting or something. Hey, the Beatles catalog is here, or at least those early songs. And there was, you know, you could show that they earn X amount a year, and we're looking for, let the bidding start at $40 million or 45. I think Jackson bought it for something
so
like that.
So McCartney just made, you know, he's one of the wealthiest men in England.
Yeah.
So he just made all of his money off touring all these years?
Well, I mean, he still gets songwriter. I mean, he gets one quarter of those dollars.
So, well, I guess.
I mean, he still gets. So Michael Jackson sells. Let's say. So anyway, so the story goes: Michael Jackson bought it off the auction block for $50 million or whatever it was. Now he owns the Beatles catalog and all that income, and he has the right to use it as he sees fit. So that's when, like, you know, Revolution showed up in a Nike commercial.
Nike commercial, yeah.
So Michael Jackson makes those decisions as the owner of the Beatles catalog. So they say, hey, we'll give you $1 million to put Revolution in Nike commercial. Jackson can just say, okay. So they do that. They write Michael a check for $1 million. Back to our lesson. Jackson keeps $500,000. $500,000 goes to the songwriter of the song, which then splits off Lennon and McCartney, $250 each. So they would have gotten a chunk for that, but they don't have the right to make the decision.
Right.
McCartney might have been gone, man, how can he sell our song to put in a shoe commercial? I mean, I know he's glad he got $250,000, but still, he might have been like a little disparate. Just like, you know, just what's next? And he put in a soap commercial, you know.
Why not?
Cheapening the whole deal. Yeah, so McCartney, and then McCartney owned all of his solo stuff. I mean,
which
is considerable.
A lot,
he owned all that. So, yeah, but McCartney's made all of his money in publishing. I mean, he owns Broadway shows. I mean, he owns all the.
Yeah.
He bought all the publishing to. Like musicals like Annie, like the song "The Sun Will Come Out Tomorrow." Like he owns the rights to that,
right?
Which produces every time it's played on Broadway or on Muzak on your elevator. You know, McCartney's just got, you know, English pounds coming through the mailbox.
That
you know?
Song makes me want to walk out into traffic every time I hear it.
Oh come on, man!
Oh yeah.
When I'm stuck with a day that's gray. Broadway Phil there for you. I don't know if I can get through the whole song.
Somebody please shoot me. Please, I'm begging you.
What's on our plate for our next segment, South? You got anything on your mind? Come on.
I got a bunch on my mind. I'm not going to give it away now, though.
All right. We're going to get into our next segment here with Kurt South. He's got a... What do you got out there in the parking lot? What did you drive over here today?
Jeep.
Yeah, the Jeep out there.
Jeep today.
Lose it. Leaking oil filled with explosives, maybe. I don't know. The current events are catching up here as Kurt South is parked at Trinidad World Recording. More with him and the world at large in our next segment. Fans, Romans, countrymen, lend me your ears. Phil Pritchett here on the P2 Podcast, coming to you from beautiful Fort Worth, Texas, in my beautiful studio, Trinidad World Recording Studio here in Fort Worth, Texas. Do you want to make that record? You thought, where can I go make that record? Man, call me, 817-733-5256, or email me, phil@philpritchett.com. Book the full band. That van will come rolling right up to your house. Unload to the astonishment of your family and friends as we just set up shop there in your backyard or your bar or your festival or wherever you are and just rock the house all the way down. It's what we do. So give us a call. Let us know we can come play for you. It's what we do, after all. Kurt South is here. Thanks for coming in today, South.
Thanks for having me.
Fighting the heat and the traffic.
God,
spring is here. Spring has sprung.
What are we going to do about the traffic on these roads? Yeah. Half of you people in Fort Worth, please move.
Let me
so
tell you
we don't
what.
Have so much.
I've got a big beef. I am not a government regulator. I am not someone who wants to pass bills and make things harder for everybody. But I tell you what, I'm about to go to the city council with a big beef. You know what that is?
All these cats?
Huh?
All these cats outside?
Yes. No, not the cats. Not the cats. Man, dudes going down the highway with their vehicles piled high with garbage. It's all over the road. Dude, I drive to work every day on 820. I mean, I'm looking up, just some truck in front of me hits like an armoire or something. Or just a desk. Or I look in the side, there's just like a washing machine over there. I'm just like, dude, are there heavy fines for that? That is dangerous, man.
You know,
I've been traveling on the roads of this state for a long, long time, and I've never seen anything like it. Just in the last few years, I've just started to go, man, there are just huge items. I mean, there's just shrapnel and debris that these dudes, you know, there's like a law. You got to have like a red flag if you have a ladder hanging out of your truck.
Well, you got to have it covered if it's like trash or tree limbs.
Yeah, but they got some rope over. I see these cars. I'm like, dude, that stuff is going to fall out, and you're going 70 miles an hour on the interstate. Is there not a law? I mean, is there no real?
There is a law against
that. What is it?
Well, you just have to secure your load properly.
Well, what does that mean? You got a bungee cord up there on a...
I don't know.
I'm just saying, dude,
That's why the traffic was so bad on 820 when I was coming here this afternoon.
Yeah, some guys...
People were stopping to watch a couple of dudes pick up a bunch of crap off of the highway that had flown out of the back of their truck. That's exactly what it was.
Yeah, there's just a mattress. I mean, dude, I ran over a mattress the other day. A mattress just in the middle of the road. You know, I mean, boom, you know, I'm just
unbelievable.
Good grief, you know, I'm just, but no one's tying it down, and you know, I'm always hesitant to just go make another rule, you know, everybody, but I'm just like, dude, it seems like it wouldn't be hard to police. You're out there, you see some dude going down the road, he's just got a big pile, dude, pull him over and say, all right, wait, is this tied down, what is this, I mean, or it's got to be covered, or something, man.
I know.
I think in the era of eBay and Craigslist, people are out there just acquiring junk. You know what I mean?
Yeah.
There's a market for crap now. There's a market for crap. So people are hoarding it.
Like my catalog.
Well,
on sale for $7 million.
That's right. That's right. No, but I do get concerned. I just drive and... I mean, you just never know you're going to come around the corner. There's just going to be a file cabinet in the middle of the street. I'm just like...
A copy of Blueprint Garage flying at your windshield.
That's right. Well, that'd be a welcome. That'd be a welcome sight. That'd be a welcome sight. But it is, man. It is a bit alarming. But this ties into another topic I wanted to get into. Look,
have you been drinking today? What is going on over there?
I'm tangled up here, Sal. Look at this.
I'm afraid PT has been hitting the sauce.
Oh, come on.
Have you?
Come on.
You can
come
tell
on
me.
Now. Absolutely not. Our friend Seth Godin, great marketer. Subscribe to it. Seth Godin, his blog. He gives you a little thought for the day every now and then. Marketing stuff, music stuff, trends in business. Great insight. You know, it's not very long. It's always very thought-provoking. He had an interesting one recently, and this ties into a lot of you young guys out there. Going to school, thinking about going to school. A little kind of interesting, because I had this very same thought. He called it the coming crash of higher education. I have my own kids, as you do, South, and I know a lot of our listeners do. When I went off to college, when my parents went to college, it seemed like it was a special thing. Maybe that started to change with my generation. But back in the 50s and 60s, man, if you had a college degree... That was a unique thing. You had gone to high school, and what's more, he has gone to college at the University of Texas or wherever. He's got his degree. Now he's out there. Well, he's a company man now. He's working for the, you know, for the company. That's my 50s employee.
The company, that was good.
You know, the man. Yeah. Well, you know, you're hireable. You're mid-management right off the bat. You know, you got a degree. You're set apart a little bit. Godin makes the observation, and back then it was reasonably affordable as well. I mean, it cost money, of course, but it wasn't just something you couldn't do. Nowadays, college is just prohibitively expensive. And what's more, you're just not getting anything truly unique. In the 50s and 60s, 70s, college was a unique thing that set you apart from the masses. Godin says that in recent years, and I agree with this 100%, it has really just become an extension of high school, except with more binge drinking. And it's just turning out more average students with average degrees. It used to be quite difficult to even get an application to like Notre Dame or Harvard. You had to just hound them. Just, could you send me an application? They didn't like people applying. They didn't know, you know. Now they just spam these things out there. They send applications to everybody. You're just getting them all the time. They've got applications. You fill out one application, and you can use that same application for like 10 different schools now. If they try to make it easy, 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 because for the marketing, for the rankings of the colleges, they want to be able to say, oh, we turned down 88% of all applicants, you know, every year. They want to be able to say, we turn people away, you know, and they just build buildings upon buildings. And you used to have, you know, if you went to Harvard, you had access to the Harvard Library. I mean, it was just a hallowed collection of volumes of books.
Stuff nobody reads.
Well, yeah. Well, nowadays, of course, online and stuff, there's just other ways to get information. You don't need, you know, access to that kind of library, though, in the 50s was very important. You know, man, I can go back and read all those old essays by their former students or lectures or whatever. Mm-hmm. And Godin just makes the point that with online courses now, like University of Phoenix, junior college and stuff, he predicts that in the coming years, that maybe my children, your children, that new generation, the parents are just not going to be as willing to cough up and put their child and themselves in debt $150,000 for the next 20 years, all in the name of an English degree and a 2.0.
That qualifies you to be a waiter.
Well, yeah, it's just kind of like, wait a minute, how much does this cost? And what are we getting here? There's just going to be more kind of like, hey, let's take a year off after high school. Maybe work a little bit. See if you really do like law. See if you do, you know, you'll do an apprenticeship or an internship at a hospital. I don't know. Just see what you think
of
it.
Go learn a useful skill
whatever,
that someone
yeah.
will hire you for. That's the problem that with a lot of recent college graduates that I know, and I know a lot of older people, I mean,
yeah.
people my age,
right.
some of whom have master's degrees, and they're tending bar somewhere, or they're a waitress or something, which there's nothing wrong with that. That's fine. But, you know, and they're still paying off $60,000 in loans.
Oh, yeah.
Like, just, man, I can't find a job that pays me more than a bartender. Well,
yeah, or waiting tables
could have done that
Joe T. Garcia's. Yeah.
Yeah,
yeah,
well,
totally.
You could have done that without the degree,
sure.
you know. And maybe they like doing that.
Right.
That's fine.
That's
but,
fine.
You know, I have a fairly distant relative who continues to get advanced degrees
yeah.
and crap that no one cares about. A lot of they've come up with these new degrees that are just useless. And
like what?
All right, if you're say you're going to get
yeah.
a degree in English literature.
Okay, right.
Or a degree in medieval studies.
Right.
You have one option, teach school or teach college somewhere.
Yeah.
Okay.
To make a good living.
But they
yeah.
only need so many of those people. They're,
right.
So, you know, you graduate and you're hugely in debt and you're qualified to do nothing
except
one thing.
Absolutely. That was Godin's precise point.
And it makes no sense and it drives me nuts. And then you have an entire, this huge group of quote unquote educated people who really aren't educated at all. They
right.
just went to college. There's a big difference between knowing something and having a
right.
degree.
Right.
And, you know, 50% of all college graduates right now mm-hmm. cannot point to New York State on a map.
Yeah.
So you're still a moron. You're just a moron in debt, and you do have a diploma
right.
that may or may not guarantee you any sort of
well, Godin's chief,
decent career.
Yeah, you're right. Godin's chief thing was just how the colleges used to be set apart in some leafy confines off somewhere where just only a select few would go learn, and that was their passion, and that's just how it worked.
Yeah.
And somewhere it turned into big business, man, and they had to all turn into big marketers.
You've got to
and
every
recruit.
Strip
mall oh, now. Man, they just recruit like heck. He goes, man, it just got into this game over the last 20 years, really, of just pounding the pavement and recruiting and trying to get everyone to apply. And, man, it the result of that is it just makes it less special mm-hmm. for the people going to school there. I'm not saying that there's you don't need a college degree, okay? Don't get me wrong. But just you're exactly right. Who wants to be equipped to do nothing, to go make no money or sitting there with a philosophy degree or something and be $85,000 in debt?
Yeah.
I mean, and that's the situation that a lot of guys are in.
Yeah.
And there's just other ways now of just maybe, hey, I took some online courses. I took a year off. I did an internship. I got a little credit for that. And then, yeah, I went on to A&M and I went for 2 years and graduated. He said, you're just going to see some more things like that, some cobbling together of some different things. And, you know, except in the most rare circumstances, just you're just not going to have a whole lot of generational folks in here, the next generation, going off and just partying balls for 5 years to get a 2.0 and just not know how to do anything.
Well, and I'm of the opinion that most people, when they're 18 years old,
right,
don't have the first clue as to what they're going to want to do with the rest of their life.
I was
in my mid-late 20s before I even had any inkling of what I might want to spend the next few years doing.
Right.
You know, and, you know, a lot of people will go and get a degree in English or a degree in philosophy or sociology or psychology. Hey, and that's great.
Right.
That's an accomplishment, and it's worth something.
It is
now,
worth something,
absolutely. Is it worth $100,000?
That's the question.
The answer is no.
Right.
But, you know, they go off and get into some other completely unrelated business or mm-hmm. field where
right.
they teach you what they want you to learn anyway, mm-hmm. or you learn on the job,
right.
and they go on to be successful. But if you say, is there any correlation between your degree and where you are now?
Yeah.
Most of them would go, no, not at all.
Yeah, but you maybe needed a degree just to get through the front door.
But a lot of times you don't even have to have that to get
in
the door.
I know, but if you just need a degree, you may kind of go, well, if I just all I needed was the degree, how come I just didn't go to TCJC? How come I spent all that money to go to
because they
North
don't
Carolina?
Throw,
you know what I'm saying? I'm just kind of like, good grief.
They
you
don't
know?
Throw good parties at TCJC. And the women don't look as good, and the dope's not as special.
Well, yeah. I mean, and Godin makes that point in his recent post that, you know, you're not necessarily universities turning out innovative thinkers and problem solvers. You're probably more turning out would-be college professors with a mediocre GPA. You know, at best, you know, mm-hmm. you're just not turning out a lot of good business minds or something. I mean, you are sometimes, but think how many people graduate from college every year in this country. I mean,
but also,
just think how many people that is out there looking for jobs. Well, how are any of them going to make me money? Me as an employer or you?
Right.
And the answer is, I don't know.
Well, like, also, you have a lot of people who the only thing that they can hang their hat on is, well, I'm very well educated. I have this degree and this degree degree. And I'm 26 years old, but I've never had a job.
Mm-hmm. Then you become a politician.
Yeah, well, exactly. So you have all these educated people who've never done anything other than go to school, and I would venture to say that is not good preparation for the rest of your life.
Yeah.
At all. And I've done both. I've worked and I've been in school, and man, there's just not a lot of there's not much of a relationship between what happens in school and success in life.
Yeah.
And if you don't have a good work ethic, and if you weren't, you know, your parents didn't raise you with certain principles and teach you to be aggressive and go and do, you know, do what you want to do, then it doesn't matter what degrees you have anyway.
Right.
You know.
And it's interesting because as my kids start to get older and there's already parents around just talking about just grades and class rank and SATs. And
who cares?
I'm just kind of like, you know, I have a hard time. But I feel like, well, I don't want to not be giving my kid the best leg up. But part of me just wants to go, look, just, you know, make your grades and just, man, be thinking about what you want to do, what you're good at. Learn, you know, and when you go to school or something, you know, go towards that. Learn how to run a business. I think that's just the mm-hmm. best thing to do. But
well,
outside of being a doctor or lawyer or something like that, if you say, well, if you don't want to be like a full-blown professional on some level, man, learn to do something. You know, learn business. Learn
or at least learn to work and put
economics.
Effort into
yeah,
something.
Yeah, just economics.
And get a good result.
You know,
that's
you know
all
run that. A... if you like to cook, yeah, like, kind of learn how to run a restaurant or open a hot dog stand. I don't know.
Go to culinary school.
Whatever.
Something. But, you know, that a lot of whether it be just a regular public school education or even a college education, is they create, you know, a curriculum for students and say, okay, here, adapt to our curriculum.
Right.
Well, I would think that maybe you should take the curriculum and adapt it to the individual.
Yeah.
What are you good at? What do you need to learn? What do you want to do?
Yeah.
Okay, do this. And really educate people with something they can use later instead of just,
yeah.
you know.
Well, the best part about a good college experience, and I certainly had this, was the experience you get, you know, outside the classroom. Just the people you meet, the experience of being living on your own. You know, in a best case scenario, you do learn how to take care of yourself and deal with stuff like that. And that's all well and good. But like you said, it's probably not worth $100,000 of debt for the first 20 years of your life. There's a lot of decisions there to be made. Because a lot of us, for so long, we're like, well, hell, I owe 50 grand, but I mean, I'll have a degree. I mean, I'll pay that off in no time.
Yeah.
And man, it is just, so the coming crash of education there's going to be some competition between universities saying, hey, man, you can get a Harvard degree for, you know, $8,000 a year or something. You know, I'm just saying they're going to have to start coming up with something because I think people are just going to be, and like I said, maybe not Harvard, maybe not the extremes, but, man, in the middle there where you've got all these universities, some of them are going to have to provide a little more bang for the buck, man, for people to go. Don't you think?
Absolutely.
I mean, I'm dad, man, and I don't have that kind of, I'm not going to saddle myself or my kid with that kind of debt, man. Just to walk out of some school, I was like, it's just not worth it. It's not worth it.
Well, I know too many people who are saddled with those debts, and they're miserable because of it. And, you know, if you just project 10 years down the road, how are you going to feel when every month you have to write a check for $400 to pay off all that drinking you did?
Yeah,
I could take you out tonight and get you drunk for $20. We don't need to do that. I mean, it's outrageous.
Oh, man. Kurt South, Collegiate Wisdom. Some parenting advice. Not really so much parenting advice, but talking about Seth Godin and his recent post that there's a coming crash in higher education. True, you decide. I don't know. Give me some emails on this, some feedback.
Don't go to college.
I know there's a lot of people out there yelling at their computer, yelling at their radios about maybe how crazy we are. Or I don't know. Is Seth Godin on to something? Kurt and I believe he might be. Well, in our next segment here, I'm very excited. We're going to talk about one of the great Colorado bands and a great band of the United States in the last, 20 years or so. Midnight Radio, the great album by Big Head Todd and the Monsters. When the sun rises again, it's somewhere in the distance. There's a tower and a light broadcasting a resistance through the rain and through the night. Fans, Romans, countrymen, lend me your ears. It is Phil Pritchett here on the P2 Podcast, enlightening your musical life. We are the lighthouse in the fog. Go to the light, folks. Go to the light. Wade through those chaotic times and find peace and understanding here with me, Phil, and Kurt South, the didactic duo on the P2 Podcast. Well, here in the vault today, folks. Oh, we got a great band here. Are they a great band? I don't know, but they at least made one great record, in my opinion. Midnight Radio by Big Head Todd and the Monsters. I got turned on to this early 90s when it... Well, I guess it came out maybe late 80s.
It was like 88, 90. 89
yeah.
when it came out.
And some guys up there at Al's, a counselor at the camp in Colorado, this one guy had it. And man, you want to talk about just the vibiest, rawest... I say it's raw, but it's actually just super, super clean. Three-piece band... Drums, bass, and then Todd playing just the strat, just a real clean tone, and his great voice. Everybody knows a bittersweet, not sweet and not bitter, bitter and sweet. A lot of y'all know Big Head Todd hits from their smash record, Sister Sweetly, which came out after this record. And they redid Bittersweet and You know, Broken Hearted Savior. Yeah, that was a new song on there.
Resignation Superman.
Yeah, they did that, and it was a huge hit. They did that at Paisley Park, Prince's studio in Minnesota. Was never really a fan. I was always kind of disappointed with those later kind of slicker records. I wasn't as big a fan of it, but I was a huge fan of Midnight Radio. It had the eeriest, darkest sound to it. Turns out the whole album, I think it was 13 songs. It was all recorded at live to two-track DAT from shows, just board tapes from rehearsals, sitting in the guy's den or something. And every song's just got this, you can sense the room around it. Some, there's kind of some crowd in the background, and they start playing. Some of it sounds like they're just at a sound check kind of playing. But, man, it's just really soulful, really clean, great songs. And a very unique band, and it shows a band that had a lot of potential and really blew up, man. They still to this day just sell out Red Rocks a couple times a year.
They're actually getting played. Yeah. They're playing Red Rocks here in a couple months with the Bodines.
Ah, Kurt Sal's favorite band, one of them.
That's a hell of a show right there, people.
So Big Head Todd and the Monsters went to Columbine High School, the now infamous high school in Colorado. They all ended up, I think, at CU Boulder Boulder and started playing. You know, gigs around there, drawing good crowds, high energy, but just guitar, bass, and drums, a band after my own heart.
They've got a keyboard player now.
Oh, do they really? Four they tour some different guys, yeah.
Yeah, cool.
How did you first become aware of Big Head Todd?
Man, just in high school, they were just big, you know. They're just one of those bands everybody knew, and I mean, Bittersweet was a huge hit back then in the early 90s.
Yeah.
And, man, I mean, I still cover that song sometimes. Yeah. Yeah, and that was one of those songs. Even people who've never heard of Big Head Todd, you play the song, they're like, oh, yeah, I know that.
Yeah, yeah, yeah.
But, you know, I've seen him a couple times live. Todd Park.
Oh, have you really?
Yeah, he's an incredible guitar player. Dude, yeah. He rips.
He's got that real just kind of sloppy, just chicka-chicka-chicka-chicka. It's kind of like the Edge meets...
it's like the
Mark Knopfler or something.
Because the real bluesy.
Real bluesy, yeah.
Especially their later stuff. They get a lot more of the blues influence in there, but... You know, for just basic stripped down rock and roll, that's kind of that. I always look to Big Head Todd to fill that need because it's. I mean, and the songs are great, man, and they just their live albums are incredible. Go check it; they've got three or four live albums. You know, and they're awesome.
But man, Midnight Radio—it just had this lonesome, you know, the sound of Midnight Radio, and that song, man, it's just got that intro that and then it's just real dynamic, real soft at the beginning, and then it just it goes into this, you know, solo, you know, he's just got great tone, great feel, just a little delay on there. I love the sound of his guitar and how he plays.
His guitar sounds awesome.
Yeah.
Well, and they're just a band that newsflash can play and sing.
I mean, the bass player and the drummer, they got really good licks. You can tell they just got good licks.
They're just locked in all the time. Well, there's that one song in there. It's like, a minute and a half long, Vincent of Jersey.
Yeah, the first song on the record, yeah.
Yeah, or Todd's just sounds like he's sitting on a
jersey.
Sitting on somebody's couch.
Yeah.
When you hear it, you're like, God, this...
Someday, somebody's gonna love me.
But it's someday. That was their first record before they... Like you say, you don't like the more polished stuff, but...
Yeah, you know, I wasn't... I was just looking forward to their next album, and it was... Oh, we redid those songs, and... I mean, they had a huge hit with it. I just wasn't... Yeah. I wasn't a huge fan of it. You know, I like that kind of older... But man, it really stands up. I think when you do maybe forego modern production techniques, unlike your buddy Bruce Hornsby, you know, I don't know. You're talking about,
but
this.
It still stands.
It stands. The material stands up. You're talking about just how it's kind of the production's kind of dated. But you know, it's kind of impossible for Big Head Todd's production to be dated on Midnight Radio. There really wasn't any production on it. It's just kind of it was just a Strat and a drum kit and a bass just kind of straight into the board and a guy singing. You're kind of like, that could have been done like last week or in
30 years ago.
In 1973. I'm kind of like, I don't know. I mean, it doesn't have like drum loops in it or it doesn't have keyboards. Yeah. You know, there's nothing like that or horns or something where you're going to go, oh, God, you know. So
horns always killer record.
You know, yeah, what is it about horns, you know? When Petty experimented with horns,
You know, horns excite me.
Use horns at your peril.
Horns excite me in a live setting,
uh-huh.
But it's like when you listen back to them, on an album or something, there's, I like it when I see a band with a horn section sometimes. If it's kind of a soulful R&B type thing.
There's something to that, yeah.
Live, it's always cool, but it's never good on the record. I don't know why. I can't put my finger on it.
I totally agree with that. But I've never even thought about that because I went and saw Sting one time. And you don't think his stuff had horns in it. He's got that jazzier stuff where he does. I mean, he had a big section up there, or like a three, trumpet sax and baritone sax or something. And then the guys, like during songs, they do a little synchronized running in place. Like it was real fun. They're just back there just going with whatever. Then they do a few blasts, And you're watching this show like cool,
It's a visual thing.
Like Bob Schneider with the scabs.
Yeah.
You go see it and you're like, wow, man, you got the horns, But yeah, in the studio with the horns playing, you're kind of like, what? You know what I mean? It doesn't really work as much. Why is that?
I don't know. It's weird.
I think it's true.
It's almost like when you're doing something in the moment, you're like, yeah, this is funny, this is cool. But if somebody's videotaping you and you watch it later, you're like, God, I'm a jerk. Look at me. What am I doing? Yeah. It's one of those things. I can't put my finger on it. I don't know why, but Tom Petty's Pack Up the Plantation.
Yeah.
I'm sure those shows, when you were there in person, were awesome.
The greatest you ever saw.
But when I listened to that record, I just hit myself in the forehead repeatedly. Like, get rid of the trombone player. What is he doing?
What is he doing?
Why was he even there?
Man, you know what? I totally agree with that. It almost, send your hate mail to philpritchard.com. When I do criticize Springsteen and his sound, same deal. You get the greatest live show you ever saw if you go to the concert. Mm-hmm. You're like, wow, it's amazing. Just listen to those records. Just I don't like Clarence Clemons. Come on, Clarence, step in here. I don't like it. Why is that?
I've officially turned my back on Springsteen. I used to be such a huge fan of his.
Oh, no.
But
Kurt,
I just got to the point where I could not stomach it anymore.
Yeah.
I just wanted to, I don't know.
Yeah.
And the horns are part of it, and the rest is his spray on tan.
But maybe in like soul, though, like when Van Morrison has a dent.
If it's in soul music,
is it rock and roll that you can't have the horns?
Yeah, but I mean, if it's sure enough soul music, R&B, a guy like Mark Broussard, it works in that context. But if you try to incorporate it into a rock and roll set, or do it, Merle Haggard would use some sax and clarinet and stuff on some of his country albums.
Yeah.
Man, when you kind of take
with
it out
mixed
of that
results,
yeah. If you take it out of that context, man, you're in danger of sucking.
Yeah,
you really are. You've got to be careful. Now, my friend Sam Anderson, who's kind of a blue-eyed soul folk singer here in Fort Worth, he's fantastic. He's done some shows in Fort Worth with the horn section. It's awesome.
Yeah,
it's absolutely awesome.
Yeah,
and I think he leans enough to the soul side that he could get away with it on a record. If I come in here with a sax player and a trumpet player, it's going to be retarded.
I crawl under the mixing desk and just think,
I'm going to do that one time. I'm just going to bring in a high school marching band one time.
Well, that is interesting. Send your emails to phil at philpritchard.com. Do horns ruin rock and roll bands? The one thing that jumps to mind where it does kind of kick ass, though, I'm thinking of one song. I mean, I always loved Bitch by the Rolling Stones.
Just, wow, you're just cussing up a storm right now.
It's the name of the song. It's a
family show.
That's kind of cool. I mean, no, you don't like it.
Stones. Ugh.
Yeah, they kind of try to be a rhythm and blues band.
I don't want to hear about it.
Yeah, yeah, that's true. Well, no horns and Big Head Todd, to be sure. Man.
That's right.
Not that I heard. I don't know any of that later stuff. Maybe a little bit. They still going strong.
I looked at their tour schedule today, man. I've heard that they're totally independent now.
Yeah,
not on any label or anything. Apparently, the last 10 years they've had a huge new wave of success on the road, and they still have their core fan base that sells out every show they do.
Yeah.
And they play big rooms. They don't play the Aardvark. I mean, they play 1,000-2,000 seat theaters most places.
When Jordan Powell, my old road manager, invited me to go underground at Red Rocks to go to that Miranda Lambert show and Toby Keith deal, so I was down there, and they had all these great photos, man, of all the bands who had sold out Red Rocks or something, man. There was like Petty and David Byrne and Dave Matthews and everybody you expect. Yeah, man, there's this picture of these guys I didn't even recognize them. I'm like, who are those guys, you know? And it was just, I was like, oh, it's Big Head Todd. He was a bunch of guys, T-shirts, just, you know. But sure enough, they'd sold it out like, you know, what, 16 times in a row or something crazy.
Yeah, they're you know? Huge up there.
Yeah, well, that's kind of their home base.
Yeah.
And very impressive, you know. But very unique. I really like his voice, you know.
It's
he just,
awesome.
He's got a real legit, there's a real honesty in there. Especially Midnight Radio, just without, there's just a charm to that kind of low production, you know, and just, and plus a lot of it's live, so they're just playing with an urgency. He's just singing, it's just peaked out, you know,
To record like that, you just have to be good.
Yeah, that's right.
And that's a lot of people don't understand, yeah. Especially other musicians who maybe are kind of new to the music business. They sweat the production a lot, and they're always talking about how
to make it sound perfect. Yeah,
yeah. Or they hear an album like Midnight Radio, and they can't appreciate
it. Yeah, that's right.
You know, and I want to go, man. In order, you couldn't do what they did. You're thinking, man, that record sounds like crap. I can go make a better sounding record.
Yeah.
You couldn't plug in the 2-track tape.
Yeah.
And sound that good.
Yeah.
If your band plugged
your guitar straight into an amp, and just play something.
Y'all would sound pretty bad.
Yeah, right.
It's like when guys go make live albums now, and then they take them into a studio and do overdubs for 2 weeks.
Oh man, yeah.
That's big business. What's the point? You know, but but they do that. And I'm like, well,
sure.
Okay. So really, you should have just gone and made a studio record, you know, and plugged in an audience track, which is what a lot of live albums are.
That's what they all are. Yeah, pretty much.
So,
man, maybe we've just taken all the honesty out of that. Yeah, you can look at Midnight Radio. A record would never get made like that today, commercially. I mean, I know they're out there, but they just
let Daryl Scott, Tim O'Brien record that's so great. It's just them sitting in Daryl's living room with a banjo and a guitar.
Yeah. Oh,
yeah. And with like one microphone set up.
Ain't no easy way.
Yeah, and you listen to that, and you're like, God, the songs are great. The guys can play. They can sing. They just rolled the tape off and sent it off to have it manufactured. There was no mastering gun or anything.
No, uh-uh.
But, you know, I mean, it's not going to get them a record deal in Nashville, but they don't want one.
So what's the difference, man? Do we want to do Midnight Radio, man, raw and real, or do you want the Steely Dan, the precise studio precision, that everything's thought out and great? They're both great listening experiences. What's the difference?
I think it's good to do both. I've done both.
Yeah.
You know, my new album, we really worked on it.
It's
very produced. I've done stuff where it's just one mic and three guys sitting in a room. You know, I think I come and go. I'll do a project that's real stripped down like that and just, you know, kind of live in the studio. Mm-hmm. And I get that out of my system, then I want to go do something really produced. Well, now after I've just finished something really produced, I want to go and just sit down around one mic with a bunch of guys and do something.
Yeah.
So I think it's good to do both. You know, Big Head Todd's done both. I mean, their live albums, they're raw, they're live, it is what it is, but I think by doing both, you show your versatility, you show this is what I sound like in this setting, this is what I sound like in this setting, and let the fans decide.
Yeah.
So
it is hard to find the impetus to do things in this day and age when everything's so easy to do. It's easy to take a laptop and just record a live show, or sit in your house and just do infinite takes of a vocal pass or something, and whereas in the old days, you had to make decisions. You just didn't have access to that kind of stuff. You're like, man, we're just going to record 2-track. We'll see what we get. So let's record multiple shows in case one's better than the other.
Right.
You know, you pick the best. That's kind of how you did that.
Yeah.
That's how I did that bootleg, you know, October Stages solo. We recorded a bunch of shows live to DAT, and that was it. I couldn't mix it. It just was what it was. It was just a board tape with acoustic and guitar and vocal. And then you've got your more precise stuff, you know, we go to the studio and you spend a lot of time on it. It's hard for me now here in my own studio a lot of times to decide what to do next, you know. I mean, I could go in here and sit around this microphone that I'm talking into right now and just bang out a couple of songs I wrote and go, well, is that the record? Is that what I want to present?
Yeah.
How do you make that? I have a hard time making that decision sometimes.
Oh, I do too.
It's without someone going, well, we're trying. It used to be, man, we're trying to get on the radio, or we're trying to get something out there. So that would limit your decision making. You'd say, well, it's got to be done quickly, or it's got to be done really well, so we can try to do this and this and this. But now in this age of the whole world's blown up, there is no music business. You just put it on your website and wait around and hope somebody downloads it on iTunes. I'm kind of like, so what do you do? What's the value in spending a lot of time on something? The coming crash of college, the coming crash of making fine musical recordings, maybe. I don't know. Well, check out Midnight Radio Big Head, Todd and the Monsters. Emphasis track for Pritchett, City on Fire. It's got that
is a good one.
It's got that great little guitar. It's real sparse. You got to stick with it a little bit. Just a little guitar. Just noodling around a little bit. That just rips into this drum beat thing and harmonica. Great stuff. I used to play that song forever.
Yeah, it's awesome.
Woke up this morning.
You and I did that song together at a show
this
years ago.
Is on fire. I love that song, man. We'll close the show with City on Fire, man. Well, all right. Email me, Phil at philpritchett.com, or call me 817-733-5256. Book the full band. We're just waiting for you to email or call to come play for you. Or come see the studio, man. Record here, whether you're recording one song because you think it might be fun, or you're waiting to make the next Dark Side of the Moon and just ensconce yourself in the studio. We do all kinds of record here as well, as Kurt was talking about. Thanks for being here, Kurt South.
Thanks for having me.
In light of all the disasters in the world.
Yeah.
Good to have you here. Well, join us next week for the podcast, everybody. Until then, we hope you've enlightened. We have enlightened your musical life. For now, and we will see you next week. Take care.
Fire, people and buildings in